sato ma sangamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma mritam gamaya aviravirmae rindrayat te dakshinamukham te namaham pahi nityam. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness unto light. Lead us from death to immortality. Reach us through and through ourselves, and evermore protect us from ignorance by thy sweet, compassionate face. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu, Ma Vindvishavahai. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. May the Divine Being
look over us lovingly as a mother and father.
May the Divine Being
support and nourish us as a mother and father.
May we have the strength and skill
to study together the art of spirituality.
May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us all. I think I should, for the sake of those who are relatively new and completely new, I think I should backtrack a little bit and explain what we are doing. This is the latest in a series of discourses on sages of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are the philosophical portion of the Vedas. I'm sure that in class and everywhere else you've heard what the Vedas are, the oldest known compositions of man, impossible to date, and of the four principal, of the four Vedas accepted authority, the Upanishads form the latter and more philosophical portions. And we have been reading the teachings of various of these sages who composed the Upanishads, or who we say they were revealed to them from inside, from the source of all knowledge, they were revealed. And these Upanishads were for a long time kept as the private property of the Brahmins, the priests, and the higher classes, learned people, pundits. And only within relatively recent times have these writings, compositions, they weren't written, they were spoken and memorized by ear. But now, of course, they're writings. But these writings have not been known to the general public of India for very many years, not many years, considering the length of the history of the culture. And we have gone through a number of these interesting discourses. Almost nothing is known about these sages other than what we find right here. Later on, there were compositions emerged which are called Puranas. And in those Puranas, stories about these people cropped up. We have no idea whether they were just invented in those later centuries, or whether there was some oral tradition that kept that story going clear back to this time. So we really do not know for sure anything about these people except what we read in this record. And that makes it more interesting because we can speculate and guess, make our own story. But the one we have to take today is called the story of Janashruti and Raikwa. It's admittedly a peculiar story. I have to confess, it's peculiar. I do my best to untangle it for us. There are others that are much simpler that we've already had, but this is today's. The story comes in what's called the Chandogya Upanishad. The Chandogya is one of the longer and older Upanishads. There are supposed to be 108 of these treatises, philosophical treatises, liturgical treatises, whatever you want to call them. The more refined parts of the ancient liturgy and ritual, the speculative and philosophical parts. But the 108 is an artificial number. There are really 12 important Upanishads, and the Chandogya is one of the most important because it's one of the oldest. It comes in the Samaveda, and the four oldest Upanishads that we know of are the Isha, the Aitareya, and the Brihadaranyaka, and this one. So, Chandogya is really authority. It's really authoritative because it starts, it picks up where the Karmakanda leaves off. The ritual portion of the Vedas is left behind, and we go into this philosophical section. But there's a transition. There's a transition from the rhythmic and ritual portions into the philosophical part. And the Chandogya has about three chapters at the beginning, which are almost exclusively Vedic, that is to say, Vedic, ritualistic, karmakanda. And they belong. This Upanishad belongs to the Samaveda, the third, the Rig, Yajur, Samaveda, which is just to identify it for you. And it is that word Chandogya comes from the word Chanda, which means meter, showing that probably the composers or revealers of this knowledge or wisdom were experts in meter, in metric matters. Everything in the Vedic literature which is sacramental is metrical, and the meter had a great influence on what was said and how it was said. So the Chandogya sages must be people who were experts probably in the chandas or meters. So this is one of the four oldest of the Vedas, of the Upanishads, and comes from the Samaveda. We like it very much because by the very fact that it contains a lot of irregularities, it gives us clues to the culture, clues to what was going on in those days. See, if you have a nice philosophical treatise which starts with a proposition and carries its argument to the end and then stops, you don't know very much about how it was produced or anything about its people. But this Upanishad has a number of irrelevancies in it, and that is not a fault. The irrelevancies tell us more about the people and what they did, and where they were, and what they were hoping for, and so on, than would an Upanishad which had no irrelevancies in it. So that's something we can be happy about. There is here, there is here in this Upanishad pure, unadulterated, elevated philosophy and moral instruction. There is also social custom, school lessons, hygiene, remnants of old legends and traditions. All of these things are found in this Upanishad. So it's a compendium, a picture, a kind of snapshot of the Vedic times, later Vedic times. And we don't know how to date that except by these artifacts, the things which appear in there. We know there was wheels, we know there were wheels, we know there were horses, we know there were cattle and so on. We know a lot of things about it, just from what's mentioned in here. There are also wild speculations, fantastic geography. Now, be careful. I should be careful. Fantastic is said from our standpoint. We of the 21st century, we make our judgments about what they speculated on and what they said and what they observed based on our understanding, which is backed up by our science. We think we know geology, we think we know astronomy, and that's all the astronomy that's worth knowing, or all the geology that's worth knowing. May not be so. It may be very interesting to know what the geology of the ancient Vedas people, some 4,000 years B.C. or more, looked like. And the astronomy, of course, we know too, that our astronomy of today is based, has been based on the discovery of the ancients of every culture. So we have to acknowledge that they weren't just fools when it came to looking around them. But one has to admit that the geology and the astronomy that one finds in the Chandogya Upanishad are, to our eyes and ears, fantastic. Well, that's preamble. We'll go now to chapter four of chapter four. The first three chapters were what I told you about. Now we come to more direct philosophy, and the fourth chapter tells us a story, and it's the story of sage Janashruti and sage Raikwa. Janashruti is not described, but this is what it says. We know that he was a descendant of a famous man. He was a grandson of a famous man. His grandfather was, we don't know what he was famous for, but he was famous. And people just have to mention his name and they know who he was. We know that Janashruti is pious, and that he is very generous with his wealth. He is not a low-caste man. The fact that he's wealthy is evidence that he's a high-caste person, because in those days, low-caste people were generally not wealthy, not in this time of the culture. Wealthy people were high-class people. So he is very wealthy and high-caste, and he is very liberal. And we're going to read what, I'll read you what it says about him. There was, the descent starts with Om. The verse starts with Om. It's expectable, isn't it? There was a descendant of Janashruta, his great-grandson, a pious giver, a liberal giver, a preparer of much food. He had rest houses built everywhere, with the thought, everywhere people will be eating my food. lesson number one. How to be proud of your charity. Mm-hmm. How to be. So he is the great grandson of someone who everybody knows, Janushruta. We've lost all the in between. But this is his great grandson, that he's a pious giver, a preparer of much food, which means that in the rest houses, now called chhatras, I think, where wealthy people would build a kind of a soup kitchen. We'd call it today a soup kitchen for the sadhus, for the ascetics and pilgrims, the people who are out in the country making pilgrimage or who are seeking the forest for sake of asceticism and spiritual practice, meditation and so on. Those people have to eat, don't they? They don't have fires. They don't cook for themselves. They don't have ovens. They don't do anything much in the way of cooking. So they have to eat somewhere. So wealthy men provided rest houses where these traveling people and ascetics could come and get their food, their meal. So it says, he is a preparer of much food, and he made many rest houses built, had them all built everywhere, had them built. He didn't use his own hands, I'm sure. And we want to know who built those houses. Were there slaves? Were they indentured aboriginals? What kind of people were they who built those houses? We don't know. But I'll tell you one thing I do know, and I think it's most interesting. He was a preparer of much food. I think it was the women that prepared the food, if you don't mind my saying so. I don't think he cooked the food himself. And that's something that you might easily pass over. I don't know whether I've ever heard any other Swami remark on this. I think it's original with me to observe that there must have been many wives involved in preparing the food for those rest houses. So that is something that you notice, the patriarchal, the masculine dominating element all the way through all of this. It's inevitable, we can't avoid it, just like all the other cultures except the original goddess culture. Well, so he does this with the thought, everywhere people will be eating of my food. My food. A lot of ego involved in this charity. Isn't there a lot of ego involved in most charity? Don't you think that many of the people who give huge sums to Emory and other universities to construct buildings would be very unhappy if their name wasn't put on the building? Almost every building, new building I've seen at Emory has the donor's name on it. Nobody wants to donate a building and leave their name off. So that's the pity of it. We mix our ego, our little self, our selfish expectations and our desires and reward seeking. We mix that with our good works. And there are very few places. There are some. There are some in Atlanta. I've worked in them. There are some places where that kind of thing is absent. Nobody has put their personal name on it. And I'm very happy to have worked in those places. But that is the first lesson of today's discourse. Well, now, in the second verse, I'll read it to you. Then once at night, some swans flew past. I'm sure there were lots of swans in those days, much more than there are now. Alas, they were probably wild swans, well, anyway, we don't know exactly what the genus of this is. It might not be what we call a swan, but flying, large flying birds. Some swans flew past, and one swan spoke to another thus. Animals are talking. It's Wizard of Oz. It's all Wizard of Oz in those days. I have to understand, all of this language is figurative, it's poetry, and in poetry animals talk, and in legend and morality plays and morality writings, animals talk. So, we shouldn't be surprised at this. Alice in Wonderland. And one swan spoke to the other and said, "Hey ho, short-sighted." Complimentary. One swan called the other short-sighted. "Hey ho, short-sighted, short-sighted." "The light of Janushruti, the great-grandson of Janushruta, has spread like the sky. Do not touch it, lest it burn you." See how cryptic it is. How cryptic this is. No wonder it was kept from the common people. The common people would toss it off as nonsense. And how many sages spent hours meditating and studying and pondering over passages like this in order to come up with some kind of continuity of thought. It's all very, very cryptic, and of course it was kept that way for generations in order to keep it secret, in order to have, for the Brahmins to have their domination over the rest of the society, they had to have secrets. Every dominating influence in a society or a country survives by keeping secrets. So, he says, "The light of Janushruti, the great-grandson of Janushruta, has spread like the sky. Do not touch it, lest it burn you." Now, what does he mean by that? Well, it's symbolic, of course, as I said, it's symbolic, like our dreams. Truth is disguised in our dreams. You remember last week or week before I spoke on dreams and how much symbolism there is in dreams, how indirect they are, how disguised they are. And that's the way this kind of lesson comes today. One swan is dominating over the other, and what the swan is saying virtually is, don't mess with, don't touch, don't monkey with charity. Don't touch a charity which is tainted. The fame of Janushruti is not something which is to be emulated. Don't eat his food, it's tainted. That's really what it means. It will burn you. Food which is charity, which is tainted with selfishness, is as good as no charity. And that food is no food. And if you touch it, if you take share in that food, you will have to share in the sin of pride of Janushruti. So that's how that's understood by the commentators. Don't touch it, lest it burn you. Now, to it, the other swan replied, "Who is this man of whom you speak? Is he like Raikwa, the man with the cart?" Now, the second swan has mentioned the name of another man, another person, apparently another liberal donor. Who is he? Is he like Raikwa? Pray, how is it with Raikwa, the man with the cart? The other swan replies. Pray, how is it? Tell us about Raikwa, the man with the cart. And then there's another peculiar verse which is inserted here. Even as all the lower throws of the dice go to the winner with the highest throw, so whatever good men do, all goes to him. He also who knows what he knows is thus spoken by me. What he's saying is that success breeds success. And you know what Jesus said about it in the New Testament, the parable of the talents. To him who hath shall be taken, shall be given, and to him who hath not shall be taken away even what he has. The peculiar parable in which the person who had the most talented and made the most money is given the extra bonus and not the person who seemed to be in need of it. And this throwing of the dice, how old is gambling? Gambling goes way, way, way back. We don't even know whether there's anything older, any human activity older than gambling. And the throw of the dice, I don't know why. He said, whoever has the highest throw, whatever good men do, all goes to him. So the person who has marshaled his forces best and taken care of his resources best is the person who gets the prize. All success goes to him. Nothing succeeds like success. You remember in the story of Yajnavalkya how the prize of the thousands of cows and with the gold on their horns and all that went to the winner who could outdo all the other sages. The sages had to argue, they had to debate, and whoever won the debate, that sage took all the cows. They didn't divide them up among the people who were runners-up. That's a modern Olympics kind of thing. In those days, the winner took all. And so he says, the gambler who scores highest gets the prize, gets all the prize. Well, the plot is thickening. Janusruti hears this in his night, in the middle of the night, and Janusruti thinks, there's somebody like me? There's somebody as good as I am? Somebody that rivals me in my generosity and the spread of my wealth and influence? Who is that? So, he is asking, who is Raikwa? Let me give you fight number 5. Janusruti, the great grandson, heard this. Then when he rose in the morning, he said to the attendant, O friend, you speak to me in the same way as to Raikwa, with the cart. He asked, how is it with Raikwa, the man with the cart? I don't know what that phrase in there means, but what he's doing is asking the attendant to go and find this competitor. Who is this competitor? Is there someone like me? Where is that person? So the attendant goes out in search of Raikwa. And having searched for him, he returns saying, I couldn't find him. And the interesting reply of Janusruti is, Janashruti is, where Brahmins congregate, go look for him. Now you see, here's another wrinkle. If he has a cart, is he a Brahmin? Brahmins didn't monkey with carts. Brahmins didn't draw carts or repair carts or do anything with carts. It's quite obvious to anyone who knows this culture that Raikwa is not a high caste person. He's a low caste person. And Janashruti has evidently intuited that this man is a low caste man with knowledge. So part of the lesson is that don't look for knowledge and spiritual attainment only among Brahmins. There are plenty of other people in the society who are also learned and capable of teaching you. So he says, I couldn't find him. And then he says to him, the attendant, where Brahmins gather, there go and look for him. And he goes out himself. And he finds a man under a cart, apparently repairing it, and says to him, must be nearby, some cart got stuck on the road. Yeah? So he goes and finds him and says to him, sir, are you Raikwa, the man with the cart? He replied, yes, I am. Oh, this was the attendant that went out and found him. And the attendant came back and says, I have found Raikwa. All right, then Janashruti took with him, now hold your breath, 600 cows, a gold necklace, and a chariot with mules. 600 cows, a gold necklace, and a chariot with mules. He's taking with him to meet Raikwa. And says to him, Raikwa, here are 600 cows, a gold necklace, and a chariot with mules. Now, sir, please teach me the deity whom you worship. Apparently he has decided, as I said, that Raikwa is a true Brahmin, a great soul, a Brahmin in truth, if not in fact. In other words, the message conveyed here is that what is valuable in a man called a Brahmin is his knowledge of truth, his scriptural dedication and adoration, fidelity to the Vedas, his application of that to his own life, the picture which he presents to the society of an upright and righteous man. All of those things are what constitute a Brahmin, and not what you're born to be by your family line. And the fact that he takes all these gifts and goes to him in that way is a demonstration of the fact that he regards him as an enlightened person, a sage who has something to teach him. All right, so he says, sir. Now, the word sir is translated into English that way, but the word in the Sanskrit is bhagavo. Bhagavo. Honored. Holy. Holy man. He goes to Raikwa and says, holy man, sir, here are the gifts that I want to give you, and I want to know in exchange what deity it is that you worship. You know, There were lots of gods in this culture. What were the gods? I can't go into that at length this morning. But they are symbols or representations of the one true entity which is ultimate in this universe. Brahman. Brahman is the name we give to the ultimate entity in this universe. The reflection of that entity in us is called Atman. And in addition to those two, or that entity and its reflection, there are the forces of the universe, which are subdivisions of the power of God. And those were called gods with a small g. And so he's asking Raikwa, "Sir, holy man, tell me the deity, which deity do you worship? How is it that you have got your holiness? I want to know who or how or by what avenue, what venue, your holiness came to you." That's what he's asking. Raikwa, listen to this. The other one replied, Raikwa replied, "Oh, keep your necklace and carriage and your cows. Let them be yours, O Shudra." New twist. He calls the king. He's a king. Petty king or small king. He calls him a Shudra. Why? That's a mystery. Keep your old cows and your mules and your carriage and your gold, O Shudra. What does this tell us about Raikwa? It doesn't tell us that he's illumined right away. And it tells us that he's very bold, he's fearless, outspoken. Why does he call him a Shudra? Well, one commentator has opined that the king didn't offer him enough. I don't buy that. That would stop the story right there. Yeah. There wouldn't be any more. I don't accept that. No. Raikwa has posted the king. He has challenged the king. And Janashruti is not fooled. He's maybe a proud man. He may be a very egocentric or egotistic man about his welfare. But he's not a fool. And he knows greatness when he sees it. And he knows how to open himself to greatness. And he's going to be going through psychological change here. He says, see, he's not fooled. And what happens is that he comes back with it. And let me give you the next verse. And then again, Janashruti, taking 1,000 cows. Cows were a dime a dozen. Yeah, the cows were just everywhere. If it sounds like a big number to you, that just remember Yajnavalkya. It's hard for us to believe, or I think, to understand or visualize a culture where cows are like dollars or something of that sort. But that's the way it was. That cows were the currency of that time. And the economy of the whole economy, you understand now why cow is sacred. We talk about the sacred cow, because the cow was the center of the economy for generations. And so this time he's going to offer 1,000 cows. He says, "I bring you 1,000 cows, a gold necklace, and a chariot with mules, and my daughter." Take heart, ladies. He has added the young girl, young daughter, to the picture. And that's going to be very interesting. He said to him, Raikva, here are 1,000 cows, and here is a gold necklace, and here is a chariot with mules, and here is a wife, and here is the village in which you dwell. Revered sir, pray teach me. Now, his village, what does that tell us? It tells us that the king, or whatever this was the name given to this potentate, Janushruti, had ownership over this village of so many villages. But he had the option of granting that village to somebody else. That's interesting. Because if the village was in his territory, is he going to do? Make a little enclave just for Raikva? Giving him a village, what would it mean in those days? We don't know. We don't know what it would mean. Would he get the income from the taxes? Would he get to be overlord over the peons? We don't know. That's one of the mysteries. But anyway, he's going to give him a village, his own village. Where he's living, he'll be supreme. All right, then what happens? Raikva does something very interesting. Raikva, lifting up the daughter's face toward himself, says, you brought these cows along, O Shudra, but merely by this face you would make me speak. Doesn't it touch your heart? Merely by this face. You have brought me this beautiful face, this beautiful girl. That'll make me talk. Nothing else will. And that's where that stops. So I have to surmise. Wait a minute. Where did my hands go? Oh, in here. Okay. So we have to surmise things here. He has, as only the only thing which has turned Raikwa's mind, never mind the cows and the money and all the village and the mules and so on. Shankara gives us a little bit of explanation here in the commentary. Let's read what Shankara says about it. He says, divine knowledge, one of the ways of obtaining divine knowledge is by the gift, by gifts. You go to a teacher and you present to him the best things that you have, the best things you can find. You offer to him, and then he becomes a source of teaching to you. It's not a bribe, it's just a way of opening the mouth of the teacher, gratifying him, showing him you have respect and devotion for him and generosity toward him. Other ways, Shankara mentions other ways of getting divine knowledge. Let's see what they are. A life of brahmacharya. Well, that was my way. Those of us who take up monastic life, we have that mode of trying to get knowledge. We take up a life of discipline, spiritual discipline, brahmacharya. Then the third way is by one's own intelligence. So you have hope. I hope you have hope. You don't have to have life of brahmacharya. You don't have to give cows. All you have to do is have sufficient intelligence. Isn't that nice? So this is what Shankara, great authority Shankara, says, that that's one of the means of obtaining knowledge just by your own intelligence. That's called Jnana Yoga, and it is open to everyone. Though a teacher is extremely helpful, it's not absolutely necessary. Ramana Maharshi, you know, Sri Ramana Maharshi, in the recent times, in our own generation, apparently got it without a teacher. And so, by one's own intellectual pursuit, one can get it. And the fourth way is by familiarity with the Vedas. Now, that is a little more subtle. That's more esoteric. What it means is that if you have memorized all of the hymns and chants and mantras of the Vedas, at least a lot of them, and your familiarity with them would mean that you had repeated them over and over until you had learned them, memorized them. It doesn't mean reading them from a book. It means that you have familiarized yourself by memorizing. And having done that, those mantras have had their effect upon you. Those, the subtle influence of that, those truths or those rituals and formulas has penetrated into your heart, and you have attained perfection or knowledge simply by your constant reciting and memorizing of the Vedic passages. That's the fourth way. So these are Shankara's four ways of getting knowledge. And this is this is the first way. You give the teacher gifts that please him, and he then begins his teaching. Now, before we go into the teaching, I would like to pause a moment and say that this is a good place to bring up what are considered to be the characteristics of a poor teacher. And of course, you can put me on the scale here now. I don't mind. Poor teacher, he's ingratiating. He flatters you in order to get you for students. He carefully preserves his image before you. In other words, he poses. You see a lot of this today in the New Thought, in the New Age people. You see a lot of this posing and image making, preserving. Typical people who run away when they see the wrong person coming. See? A poor teacher compromises the highest truths for fear the students will be displeased. Can you give an example of that, anybody? Well, you know what it is. Maybe if you can't give an example, but you know what it is. There are people who know what the highest truths are. They don't dare to speak them. I think that was the characteristic of the whole Brahmin caste for centuries, that for one reason or another, they were afraid to tell the common man, to expound the common man, these esoteric truths. So they compromise for fear, out of fear. Another one is, if offered gifts, they may feel obliged to refuse for the sake of appearances, but a lingering fondness for those gifts remains in the heart. No, I don't want you. Oh, looks pretty good. What nice food. No. I've been guilty of that. They offered even offered gifts, they may feel obliged to refuse. Or the poor teacher tries by calculation to keep just one jump ahead of the pupil. And the story I like to tell about that is, look at the candor and simplicity, utter simplicity and absence of calculation of Sri Ramakrishna when the young man Hariprasanna came to him. One of his band of monks came as a young man, and Sri Ramakrishna welcomed him into his room, and after a few exchanges of words of politeness, he said to this young man, "Can you wrestle?" And he said, "Yes, I know something of wrestling. I know what college students know of wrestling." Sri Ramakrishna said, "All right, come on, let's wrestle." He wrestled with Sri Ramakrishna, backed him up to the wall, of course, mm-hmm. completely pinned his arms down. And Sri Ramakrishna said, "Oh, you win. Good, you win." No. So he wasn't a poor teacher, because no poor teacher would do that. I just give an example of being the opposite kind of a teacher, you see. So, by insulting the king, Raikwa rejects all those modes of teaching. And the question arises, now, why would Janashruti want to give so much for a simple teaching? All he wants to know is about the deity that Raikwa worships. Why would he want to give all that wealth and all those cows for that teaching? We don't know. We don't know whether it was a fact or whether it's hyperbole. The point that's being made is, how valuable is spiritual truth? How valuable is spiritual truth? Jesus said there was a man who had a pearl of great price. And, he had lots of things, and he sold them all. Having found a pearl of great price, he gave everything that he had for that pearl. He saw that that was the most valuable thing. And what this lesson is trying to teach us is, where truth and the heritage of passing on truth are not highly prized or valued, a small price can be asked. Go to your temples, rather go to your churches. What do they ask? One-tenth, a tithe, one-tenth of your income. Mosques, I think, ask one-seventh. And what do you get? Not a whole lot. Now, my lesson from this is that where the price is small, the expectation of the result, the purchase, is also small. And where the price is kept high, in understanding, a comprehension of the value of that truth is appreciated. Here in the Vedanta Center, we do not charge you to hear the truth, but we warn you very clearly that if you want to realize this truth, if you want to experience God, if you want to know what the love of God means, if you want to know what the knowledge of God means, you have to give your all. We don't fool you about that. We don't charge you to listen, but if you want to take what you hear seriously and put it to practice in your life, you'll find eventually that it takes all you've got. That's what I want to tell you about this. We warn you about that. You may say, well, the best things in life are free. The old song. That's true. But that means truth cannot be bought. The highest truth cannot be bought. That's what that means. The best things in life are free. They are not for sale. So, whatever we may contribute here at the center, we are not buying truth. Whatever you put in donation box, or whatever you give in your annual pledge, or whatever it is, understand that we are not buying truth. We are divesting ourselves of the veils which cover and interrupt that great light of truth, the light of God. I think I won't try to go into Rick Reichwa's teaching this morning. We've had a long discourse already. So we'll, some other time, we'll go into what Reichwa teaches. It's extremely cryptic anyway. But we'll let him do that for us another time. Are there any questions or comments that you have on this? Well, if not, our lesson is over. And we have a couple of visitors here. Will you tell us your names? From Piedmont College.
I'm Diane Meyer.
And then Danielle.
Daniel Bailey.
Their teacher brought a whole class, or whole section of a class, last week on Wednesday evening for a period, an hour and a quarter or so with us. And they weren't able to come at that time, so they came this morning. I'm sorry you missed the other one. It was much more interesting than this morning. But Barbara Brown Taylor is bringing me class after class. And another one's coming in October. So it's very rewarding to be able to talk to these young people and to hear their questions and to see how their eyes and their minds open when they hear some of these surprising things. I have been asked to distribute that announcement on the paper to our congregation. That's why I've given it out to you. Take it if you like. If you don't, leave it. There are a couple of other announcements. On Friday night, coming Friday night at 8 o'clock, we have an exceptional extra meeting. Swami Japananda of India will come and talk to us. He is the instigator of a tremendous piece of work with lepers and blind people in institutions in Karnataka, in India. He has one of the largest social service organizations in that part of the country. And I don't know him myself. I hope that you all will come out on Friday night, as many as you can, to come out and welcome Swami Japananda. And then you already have the other announcement about 9/11 memorial service. So let us say our benediction. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace
in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Oh.
Om, peace be to us, to all beings everywhere.